This is the 14th annual conference of the Qualitative Report. I think this is our third online. I think this is our third one that we've gone on online. And so our theme for the conference is living in a post-COVID world. I hope it's post. Maybe it's not. Maybe it will always be having some sense of a COVID world. And so I'm joined this morning with my fellow co-editors-in-chief, Sally St. George and Dan Wolf from up in Calgary. So I'll do a few announcements, and then we'll get into our first panel. And this is the first time we're doing, instead of an individual speaker or co-speakers, doing our plenaries, which help usually are based upon the theme and help us to kind of, you know, sort of set the stage for the rest of the conference. We decided to go with panels this year. So this is the first of three. So let me do a couple of the housekeeping announcements. Adam works very hard on these announcements, and he wants to make sure I get them correct. So you've all received the email. Well, those who are here, I guess you have, is that at the top of each presentation group, there's A, B, and C over the 3 days. Please check your presenting time. It's all on Eastern time for that. And then all you have to do is to click on the Zoom link at the top of each breakout session so that you'll see that there'll be the little table, and it'll be, maybe you might have three presentations at that time, but there'll be one Zoom and you'll all be in the same Zoom room with a moderator. If you've looked at the schedule at a glance, we're hosting 5 special events during the conference. We have the Invivo Power Lunch on Thursday, which is today. So you get to supply the lunch, we'll provide the power. And then we have Max QDA on Friday and Quirkos on Saturday. Saturday afternoon, there is a open house for the NSU Qualitative Research Graduate Certificate, and then the TQR Editorial Board meeting, informational on Saturday, and everyone's invited to that. We give you an update as far as how TQR, the journal, is doing, and also our conference and social media and those sorts of things. So we have done everything possible, and Adam has done everything possible to prepare a successful conference event. If there is an internet interruption, you'll have the conference back online as quickly as possible. In the event one Zoomer is temporarily unavailable, please join another breakout room until we get the room back up. So I think the first year we did that, AT&T had an outage on the entire eastern part of the United States. So hopefully that will not happen this year. Although my neighborhood, their trucks always seem to be outside our door, so who knows? Please note there's a room moderator in every breakout room, and we'll do our best to assist you with the technical details of presenting online. And you can improve your chance of a smooth and seamless presentation by practicing both your presentation and utilizing Zoom prior to getting into the event. We have something new this year. We were contacted by the group over in England, the British Psychological Society, and you may be familiar with their qualitative methods in psychology group. And what they've asked is that they are asking you all if you'd be interested in doing event reviews, so that you would be like they're the beat reporter or the cub reporter, and that you would be writing short pieces for the conference. So it's the information, let me go over here for a sec.
And I just posted a link if you're interested for some more information about that in the chat.
So I'll just for a sec, I'll go here. So this is our tqr.nova.edu. This is our community page. So you just have to scroll down a little bit. So just go to tqr.nova.edu and did I lose everybody? Oh.
No, we're here.
No. You're still there. Thank you.
Because
it looks like we lost Ron.
I'm sure. Oh, Ron, you're on mute.
No, you're on mute.
Probably. Wow, that's weird. Yeah, no, it just came up, I guess, because I was saying how great Zoom is, it decided to go down for a couple minutes. So yeah, just go to tqr.nova.edu, and you'll be able to see the information, and you can submit little blurbs to them. And India Amos is the person who is the organizer of that. And so you can also email to that. So let's get started. This is the opening plenary, and we have the three of them today. We're looking at qualitative research in a generic sense. We're all part of that world. And since 2019, we've been living in a worldwide pandemic of COVID with the hope soon we may be passing through the passing of the disease. Now here we are in 2023. As the virus continues to affect our lives, we as qualitative researchers know we have an important role to play in exploring, describing, analyzing, interpreting, and criticizing this new world, or how new a world we're going to talk about today. In our first opening day opening panel, three leading qualitative researchers share their pre, peri, post-COVID experiences and offer insights on qualitative research present and future. So we see that it's kind of like three interrelated conversations. So I think a way of getting us started, I'll introduce myself, kick it over to Sally and Dan, and then we'll turn it over to Maria and to Johnny and to Jessica. So as you introduce yourselves, that's how you can kind of start talking a little bit about pre-COVID, what you were doing. We go through that round, and then we'll jump into your COVID experience, and we'll play that out a bit, and then we'll move it on to where you see qualitative research going in the future. And that could be a very personal view, or it could be more in terms of based upon what you've learned, your reflections, and so forth. So I'm Ron Chennai. I'm co-editor-in-chief of the Qualitative Report. I'm here at, I'm doing my branding here. I'm at Nova Southeastern University. And welcome everybody for being here. And I look forward to this conversation. So let me kick it up to Canada.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sally St. George. And one of the COVID changes for us is that Ron asked Dan and me to join him as co-editor-in-chief. And it really got, I think, our creative juices going. So thanks, Ron. Welcome to everybody.
Well, I'd like to say welcome to everybody as well. A thousand of you plus, as we may see you off and on throughout the next 3 days. I'm sitting here with a new hip I got 2 weeks ago, so I'm excited to be here and considering doing an autoethnography of the experience of getting a new hip. So happy to be here. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, that's an amazing idea for an autoethnography. I'm Maria Lehman, and I'm a professor at the University of Northern Colorado in Colorado, USA. And I think I'm a really good example of pre-COVID, where I had never taken a class online and I had never taught a class online. And the not teaching was deliberate. Obviously, we certainly had hybrid and online classes, but I would kind of use this deflecting joke where I would say, oh, I'm an in-person act, and just be able to deflect and have an adjunct or maybe a newer professor teach the online courses. And so I also write in culturally responsive ethical qualitative research, and how do we write and represent research accounts. So I think it's really interesting reflection on me that I was writing about how you might want to write that digitally, but also not wanting to teach digitally.
I'm Johnny Saldana. I'm professor emeritus from Arizona State University. I was considering myself a tech dinosaur, that I never wanted to get up to speed with any technology or software, et cetera. But even before COVID, I could see that slowly starting to emerge into my life, and COVID accelerated my use of technology. And so that has given me a couple of thoughts about how qualitative inquiry and technology interface. Jessica?
Thanks, Johnny. Hi, everyone. It's good to see you all. And thanks, Ron, for the invitation to join this morning. I'm Jessica Lester. I'm a professor of qualitative methodology at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, which is in the Midwest region of the United States. So prior to COVID, of course, not all of my empirical work was living in a digital space. But I was really, and still am, very interested in the intersections of technologies and qualitative inquiry. And certainly it was graduate students that I worked with who really pushed me and knew a lot more, and still do know a lot more, about what it means to do qualitative work in a digital environment and leverage digital tools. But of course, qualitative work really changed for all of us, even if we were dabbling in that space as COVID came on the scene, when it really became a mandate that we work in these digital environments. And so with COVID, all of my empirical work, I had to rethink it and think about what it means if I'm working in digital space. Can I even continue these various projects? And some I couldn't. So certainly there were shifts, but this remains an area of real interest for me of what it means to work at that intersection for us as qualitative researchers.
Yeah, you were kind of ahead of the game, Jessica, in terms of your work and looking at the technology. So what was your life? What was your life as far as during the last couple of years, in terms of doing this qualitative research thing?
Yeah, well, I think you're directing it to me, so I'll just go ahead and start, Ron. Sure. So for me, as I just mentioned, I did have several projects that I felt had suddenly a mandate, and it was a literal mandate for many of us, where our institutions mandated that we stop travel, which impacts a lot of us that do ethnographic work in place-based ways. So for me, it required rethinking whether I should pause projects, because not all projects can live in digital spaces, as well as how might I leverage some digital tools that I might not be familiar with that might help me sustain projects or reimagine projects. So for some of my work, it just required thinking differently about the design, but also thinking differently about the methodology, because many methodological practices haven't intersected with technological ideas. And of course, methodologies are human inventions. So what does it mean in this historical moment to think differently about methodology in these digital spaces? So for me, some of the projects immediately went online and others paused and are just restarting now as I can engage in place-based research activities. Maria, how about you?
So I tend to be what we call in South USA, someone who borrows trouble. So I have to work against that. But right before our spring break, I was teaching three qualitative doctoral classes, methodological classes. I said, let's take a vote. Are we going to come back or not? Because I thought the university was dragging its heels and my international students were feeling really uncomfortable in the class. And so two classes we voted, we won't come back. And I would learn how to teach by Zoom over spring break. And then the other class, one student was in the class for access reasons, face-to-face. So she and I would come back and the rest would be on Zoom. And so basically I taught myself how to teach over spring break. And by the end of spring break, the university said, oh, we're not coming back. And I was amazed how many videos there were about pedagogical ways to make your classroom this warm and hospitable place. And basically I've been someone who I now have delivered dozens of webinars online about how to do qualitative research. I figured out how to do hands-on activities through this Zoom. And I'm really a convert because it makes things more accessible at the international level. And so for example, a conference like this, we won't necessarily all have the money to travel to it. And then certainly I have two Gen Z children and they really like the fact that we're not necessarily using up environmental things. Although I was telling Ron, they would have very much liked to have been in Florida. So we have this green component where, you know, hopefully we're headed to a more hybrid nature. And I want to hear what Johnny says, but later I would like to say something about almost every one of my students' research was face-to-face prior to the university shutting down. So that was fascinating. Johnny?
I had my very first online interview experience through Zoom because of COVID. Beforehand, all of my interviews had been face-to-face, focus groups, individual interviews. But with COVID, I had been commissioned to do something before the COVID pandemic hit. And then by the time COVID was in full force, I couldn't do those interviews face-to-face anymore. So learning how to interview online was a real education for me because I had recorded all of the interviews so that I could transcribe them later. And I noticed something about me I never knew before. I was deliberately trying to look interested and immersed in what my participant was telling me. But as soon as I saw the video, I thought that I looked so bored and out of touch. So that really was a wake-up call for me that, oh, what might my participants have been thinking about me, thinking that I had no interest in whatsoever in what they were saying when I was trying to look engaged. So that really taught me about how I come across in Zoom. The other thing is that I did a keynote for another Florida group online. And I said that I had noticed, of course, through Google Scholar alerts, how many articles about COVID-19 were starting to come out, its effects on teaching, its effects in healthcare, obviously. And I was wondering, well, since I may not be able to do face-to-face field work anymore, what do we do? And I propose that during the interim, we take a look at three different qualitative methodologies. Look at the case study as one example, so that within your own geographic proximity, who can you study in depth? What case can you look at intimately, since you have to sort of, if you will, stay geographically bound? Yes, maybe you have to wear the masks, but if you're able to have that live interaction, great. The second modality is to think about the confessional tale from von Manen, who said that this is where the researcher writes reflexively about things that have gone wrong, so that what you're writing about now are research studies that you've already conducted. How might you have done them differently? What kinds of lessons did you learn that you might be able to pass on to your readers or your audiences? And the third one is to take a look at autoethnography, because if we're bounded in space, and then this is the opportunity for you to write about yourself and your particular cultural experience. So those were the major kinds of headlines that came across to me when I think about how does COVID affect qualitative inquiry. Mm-hmm. Ron, what would you like us to discuss next?
Well, I can add about the autoethnography. Yeah. So, Johnny, thinking about the autoethnography, I had both my children in the home for school, like other people did, of course. And I also had this real sense of my privilege. So my sister calls it a princess problem. So any problem I was having as a professor was so different than people that had to be out on the front lines. But I would get this overwhelming sense of desperation. And so I would just, we had this snowstorm and I would open up my full door and just thinking this, I just wanted to walk out the door. And I kept thinking, oh, you're suffering from some kind of privileged depression. Well, my 11-year-old at the time walked up to me and said, what are you doing? Because, you know, if she would fan the door, I would say, you're wasting energy. And I thought, how would you tell your child I'm thinking about walking out the door? I happened to be barefoot. And I said, I'm thinking about running in the snow barefoot. And she said, what, really? And so we introduced this tradition where every time we have the first snow, we all run through the backyard barefoot in the snow. And so I was able to take this real deep kind of mother scholar depression and turn that around to something that was joyful for my children. And that's the way I'm framing the autoethnography I'm writing about COVID now, whenever I get moments to work on that. And I agree, it's this powerful way of saying, how does a privileged person have space in this conversation, because my problems are real, even if they're only real for me.
Yeah, I like that. As you were were talking, you know, I know it's sometimes a commercial qualitative research, let's say, well, qualitative research is interview, and then there's ethnography, which is more out in the field. And so I think definitely, except for maybe someone's digital world, we didn't have access to, you know, walk side by side with them during COVID. So I don't know if there's going to be a tipping point that we're going to see predominantly more interview research. Although it seems to me that if someone, you know, the technology can also allow you to, how do you kind of get in their space? Like you were talking about, Johnny, about casework, and Jessica, you're talking about doing ethnographic work, more about the participant observation kind of thing, those things. Where do you see this kind of shaking out as we go forward? Is it going to put it one way or the other, or are we going to find ways, or maybe be more technology enhanced doing what we're doing, although I definitely see autoethnography is definitely becoming quite something. So where do you see these kind of, I guess, along methodological, technological, where do you see things going?
I can start. I mean, I think one thing that's helpful for us to keep in mind as a qualitative research community is that people aren't just using digital technologies, they're living through them. I mean, we all are living through it right now, joining a conference and engaging in this way. So given we all, across methodological perspectives, have an interest in studying meaning-making practices, inevitably, we will be intersecting with how people are interacting with technologies, broadly defined, in their meaning-making practices. So there's no escape. But that doesn't mean that, you know, first of all, technologies are never neutral. They always bring consequence with them. And also we know that when we think about technologies as qualitative researchers, I think we often, particularly post-COVID, if it is post, but post-COVID, we think about interviews. And, you know, there's lots of good literature, and there has been even prior to COVID, folks like Janet Sammons have written lots of nice guides on what it means to do virtual interviews and focus groups. And in some of that literature, it points to like expanding who your community is, expanding who your participants are. But of course, we also want to keep in mind that about a billion people are without electricity and without broadband internet. And so that's a myth. It's not always going to be expanding. And so I think one of the things we have to keep in mind when we're making methodological decisions is what are the consequences for adopting a given technology or re-envisioning my methodology in a digital environment. And so to your point, Ron, I think it's a both end. I don't think as we move forward, it's about ignoring all the things we've learned methodologically in place-based practices, but it's also thinking about, are there places where we can leverage technologies to make sense of people's social worlds in ways that are meaningful? And of course, there are people that their social lives are in digital spaces, and so it makes sense to take up things like virtual ethnography or netnography. Or digital forms of methodological practice. But of course, there are other spaces where that's not sensible and not in alignment with the way people are living their lives. So I envision it as a both end and something that we have to recognize and reckon with as part of the way we are all living our lives now.
Kind of a different take on mixed method.
One of the things that came to my mind as Jessica was sharing was some universities during COVID changed their doctoral students' dissertation requirements to doing such things as extensive literature reviews rather than field work because the field sites had been shut off to them because of COVID. But I actually thought that's, for some people, that's not a bad idea because, with our information overload, we really need a lot of good meta-syntheses and meta-ethnographies now to really pull together what's going on with the literature. There was something else about COVID is that if I wanted to, I could go out now and do some field work because, depending on where I go, I could go back to it. So we're slowly getting out of this technology only kind of world. Mm-hmm. And we have the opportunity to get back into the field. The other thing that came to my mind was social media studies. The literature in qualitative inquiry on research in social media is really starting to explode. And it has been actually for, a couple of decades, actually, but even more so now. We're starting to see that literature in how we take a look at technology. And all you have to do is just realize, I was reading the Handbook of Social Media, and there were lots of studies on Twitter. And then with Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, all those studies now are just sort of, they're irrelevant now because Twitter has changed so much. And so we're constantly evolving and changing. And it's kind of difficult to keep up with the technology, but it is certainly a field and an avenue that's just ripe for research.
I appreciated Jessica's comment about people that aren't on the internet. And so I'm Mennonite, and our most traditional groups of course, like the Amish, deliberately don't use technology. And then, of course, we also have wealth issues or other reasons people might deliberately not use technology. And then if we look globally, like Jessica said, it would be even more. So that is a really important piece. And before COVID, I would always say that, which many of you were probably trained this way too, in person is always better. You need to have some kind of reason, like geography or something, that you're doing phone interviews. Now I think you could take a critical perspective and you could offer to your participant, would you rather meet in person or would you rather meet through Zoom? And we can offer that to them, where we put that kind of decision in their hands. The first dissertation I had go through COVID, we had a plan A and B, because if you remember, we had this sense like, is this going to be a couple weeks, couple months? And so plan A was she was going to be in a special ed classroom, elementary classroom. And plan B is she was going to do this virtually. They did bring those children back first before the rest of the children, but no external person was allowed in. And so the teachers took an iPad and walked her through a tour of the classroom and had her observe in those ways. And so I see increasingly this kind of burgeoning of technology methodology. For example, I was just looking at one the other day called podcast ethnography. And so I think this area is becoming really creative and fascinating.
It's kind of a multidimensional world. I did a presentation a couple of weeks ago about scholarly productivity of faculty and so forth. And it was the create your publication plan. So like the long-term plan and then the short-term plan for a project. And this website I went on to then had your whole post-publication plan. And it was like the podcast, the popular, the so forth. So there's these multi-dimensional. I'm just amazed that people, I guess my first experience was I went away to college. It was hard for me to live both in my hometown friends and then the college that I was in. And then going to email and going online, it was like this multi-dimensional thing. And so, yeah, we may see more of these kinds of things happening. But as far as I know, the digital divide didn't go away during COVID. And that's something that we have to kind of figure out. I know Johnny presented at a conference up in Banff, and he talked about, does it make sense to put a limitation section in a qualitative report? Yeah, we are talking about, how do we then define the limits of our study because we have budgets and time, and how do we challenge those limits when we're trying to be inclusive and immersive and to have that kind of, remember the intensive, extensive, it really adds a different definition when you're looking at all the different ways, all the different digital worlds that people live in, and what does that tell us about lived experience or the culture.
Yeah, I said that what we would look at or what we should do look at, and I'm seeing it happen little by little in the published literature, is rather than a limitation section, you have what are called parameters. In other words, these were the boundaries. These were the things that I was working with. You don't talk about how much money you didn't have. What you talk about, what were the resources that you have? It was almost taking a kind of an appreciative inquiry stance towards the parameters or the boundaries that you were working with.
And that's a challenge too. I think I was talking about a couple of years ago, when I read papers from other authors from other countries, it's rather common in the literature section to see sources from languages other than English. Yeah, people don't think of anything when every one of their sources are English language, and not seeing that there's relevant literature from other areas. And so we were talking about even in a PDF document, it's not as easy as like a Word document to get Word to translate it to you as you have in a PDF. There are those kind of limitations. So this move towards, so it seems that there's kind of our theme so far has been, technology's here, because people moved into a more digital world if they could. We're trying to make sure that we're tapping into that. So what do you see as our biggest challenges with that overly technologically infused qualitative research.
Well, I don't know if there's one big challenge. I think there's several challenges. I think one of the challenges that we have to just as a community remain reflexive about is the digital divide, and recognizing that that divide also cuts across researchers. So I think about like qualitative data analysis software packages, not all languages are interfacing with those packages. And so there are certain researchers who speak particular languages that have privileged access to certain qualitative data analysis software packages. It's one example of how, you know, inequities hit across researchers as well. We also know when it comes to qualitative data analysis software packages that if you don't have an institutional license, your chances of gaining access will require some kind of fund for you to gain access to. So we see inequities there. And then of course there's the divide across communities of who has access to broadband internet. And while also I would say, you know, also while we talk about digital spaces offering, you know, a more accessible environment for people to gain access to things like conferences, we know that the design of digital spaces also is not one that encompasses all people's body mind. So even that requires us to be thoughtful around, for instance, is Zoom-based interview something that my research participants would find accessible? And how can I make sense of that if it's something that they can access and that it is their preferred mode of communication? Or would this create inaccessibility for those participants? So anyway, all that to say, I think one of the really important kind of concepts to put at our kind of at the foreground of our thinking is around inequities. And then for me, a second one is just recognizing that technologies are never neutral. They can be really exciting and they seem so neat, but they have, as some have written about, hidden opaque forces. And so there are consequences even with things living in the cloud. And sometimes we don't foresee what all of those consequences might be when our interviews automatically are saved to the cloud. Is that okay? What are the implications for that? So anyway, all that to say, I think as a qualitative research community, we have to keep this potential for an equitable access and equitable practice related to technologies, as well as the potential for consequences that will always be with us with our use of technologies.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, as you were talking about, you know, being comfortable with Zoom, maybe we'll move to all our interviews are conducted in TikTok.
That's not as crazy as it sounds, because I read some of the literature where adult researchers are working with young people, teenagers and so forth, and they're getting data in real time by having them tweet to the researcher or TikToking to the researcher what's going on. There was a study I read about where the researcher was unable to go or didn't feel comfortable going to those kinds of crowded spots where the possibility of catching COVID was quite real. But the younger people were very interested. You know, they had a little bit more courage about them, and they did go to those spaces like clubs. And so what they did was they tweeted to the researcher or gave short videos to the researcher about this is what's going on right now. And so she was having, if you will, field work by proxy. And I thought that was a very intriguing idea. So the more of the literature that I'm reading about very innovative ways that qualitative researchers are figuring out how to use technology as a tool for data collection.
Yeah, I agree, Johnny. I'm a former elementary teacher, and I notice if K-12 starts to use social media or something like that for pedagogy, it's almost always something that researchers could do too. And I had noticed there's a way, and I'm not a TikTok expert, that you can do a group. And so teachers will have the kids TikTok out after a lesson to show their levels of understanding within that locked group. So it would make sense. It could be a focus group of sort, if you will. But I do want to echo Jessica said, it's this idea of glittery technologies. So we don't want to just jump into something because it's new and fascinating and amazing, of course. And a lot of times as methodologists, we're lagging behind where researchers are in already doing things. And so it's this methodological piece. How can we look at it and look at what does it afford and what constraints there are? And then what should we be concerned about in data security? Because of course, data security is this huge area that Jessica was discussing. My understanding, for example, is Canadians cannot save things on certain servers that are owned by the US, because the United States is very aggressive about looking at things that we traditionally would have thought of as private. And so we have to always be thinking about that type of thing with our data.
And Maria, what you just said just made me think of one other thing, thinking about TikTok. Of course, you know, the other thing that we can think about with these spaces is that it's producing really big data for us as qualitative researchers. And I think that's another prime place for the qual community to think about what is our place when it comes to, what does it mean as qualitative researchers to work with big data? What counts as big data? How do we work with big data? We have some guidance and some very small literature bases around this in the methodological literature, but that opens a whole can of worms related to ethics. Who owns images on Instagram? Can we claim them as our own? Is it public? What counts as public data? And the same with TikTok videos. Those are phenomenal reserves of meaning-making practices that we could access, but what are the implications of accessing those from an ethics perspective, and how do we navigate that?
Another thing that I've seen coming out is publications on how to teach via Zoom, how to instruct fieldwork and qualitative inquiry through mediated instruction as opposed to, you know, live classrooms. And so that's another aspect that technology has affected is what are, if you will, the best practices? What are the most effective ways of instructing qualitative research through mediation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, when we went to fully virtual in my ethnography class, we were just getting ready to start a week on ethnographic research poetry. And so normally you could picture in a face-to-face classroom, we would have had centers where they were cutting things up and pasting at one center, another, they were working perhaps with word clouds with their data, moving through these centers. And I thought, wow, these students have so much pressure on them. How can I say, okay, let's learn about poetry? And so I had actually decided not to do it. And I woke up in the middle of the night and just completely changed my mind. I thought, what if that's the exact thing they need? Many of my students were completely isolated by themselves in a room. They weren't with anybody, just in a dorm room type scenario, if you will. And so we ended up being able to publish it, and it's called Pandemic Poetry. The one student wrote an ode to his chair because he spent all his time sitting in his chair and about how this chair was supporting him through this situation. Another wrote about how she got out her little sewing kit they had given her when she was 8, and she started sewing masks with this sewing kit. And so these were really powerful pieces. And so I kind of laugh at myself now how I thought this face-to-face thing that was so powerful couldn't be translated into Zoom. And they both had their own strengths, but it ended up being an amazing experience.
We've touched upon it here and there, and we're definitely seeing at the journal more arts-based work. Certainly autoethnography would be one aspect of it. And you see, like during the COVID, people found different ways of expressing themselves. And we're still a very heavy text style. You know, we turn talk into transcripts and so forth. Do you see us being more varied in terms of what constitutes our data or what and how we present the results or how we do our analysis? What are your thoughts on that?
I would say that I think for quite some time, there's been a longstanding interest in being more varied, but I think many of us hit a kind of a wall when it comes to expectations for some folks, promotion and tenure and what journals you should be in, but then also just not having a lot of journals that are able to support anything beyond text. And so I think there's a great interest in seeing kind of an explosion of different ways that we can share and represent our findings. And then thinking about how that plays out, like you just said, Ron, within the context of something, a journal like TQR, like what kinds of supports would be needed on the journal side to make it possible to, for instance, include movement in your publication. So not have static text, but have movement representing something that doesn't just stand still. And so anyway, all that to say, I think there's great interest and a desire for us to think about how we might transform some of the journals that are longer standing. Of course, there are some examples like Virtual Ethnography has several journals that focus on, Visual Ethnography that focuses more on visual representation and publishing film and publishing visual artifacts. But again, everything is very static. So if we think about how might movement be part of our publications, I don't think that we have options that are available to us yet.
I don't know what the APA guidelines are for memes.
As someone who publishes traditional textbooks, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to do that, we all understand that there's a money part that locks up the information from coming out. And so I was keynoting in a country where this was before COVID, so it was in person, where the attendees wouldn't have been able to afford in general the textbook because it hadn't come out of the Western pricing market yet. And so I kept trying to think with the next textbook, how could I do this differently? And so I developed a set of a podcast for each chapter and a set of infographics that would go with the textbook, but you could start to, I delivered that myself, and you could start to use that ahead of time before it moved into where it would be at the price where either your library could acquire it or you could acquire it, because, you know, somehow we have to make sure that this information is more available. And obviously, as Jessica just said, the qualitative report understood this many, many years before many of us did, as far as full access, yet also the monies to support the publications. It's a really tricky issue.
I have to admit that I have intrapersonal conflicts with COVID. I call it COVID fatigue. And I know that, you know, we have been living through this pandemic for, you know, about almost 3 years now. And there are times when I'm so tired of reading about COVID. I'm tired of writing about COVID. It's not that I want to deny it. It's just a fatigue with it. And so I'm seeing, again, conferences and other things that are related to COVID, but I'm hoping that we have, in a way, reached a peak and start exploring other topics. I acknowledge how COVID-19 has reshaped my practice as a qualitative researcher, but that doesn't necessarily mean I have to focus on it as my research question. As I say, that's a kind of an intrapersonal tension that I'm wrestling with myself now.
Yeah, we had a meeting yesterday at the university. Since 2020, we've had a special process by which we reviewed international travel, and I had to go through our COVID, you know, czar. And so we've decided we're going to go back to the way it was before. You know, there's countries that are like the no fly that because of political or so forth like that. So COVID will be maybe a part of that, but it could have also be other health concerns. So that to me was a sign, Johnny, of that, okay, it's kind of moving back a little bit to be a part of something else, but not being the overarching tenor of the decision as far as where students are going and that. Maria, one thing that you talked about that I think is the next thing, you know, for 30 years, we've done open access at the journal. And so I think that's been a value. You know, every day, you know, 3,000 papers are downloaded, you know, free. Wow. And so I just wonder with the, not just a digital divide. So I think that's our role to try to get free material out there. And the top downloads for our journal is usually always how-to articles, how to do interviewing, et cetera. So there's the movement, the OER, Open Educational Resources, which are the idea of, you know, I mean, people could teach themselves, downloading an article, could translate into their own language and so forth. But the notion that will textbooks go away? Will everything be open access so that regardless of whether you're at a university or not, because just like the cost of food goes up, the cost of subscriptions to journals goes up and so forth like that. And you all write books and that. So as far as qualitative researchers producing, you know, the choice of you send your paper to a journal that has an open access model, where do you see your textbook writing going in the future? As far as this, will this open education resource thing take off?
Well, it's already taking off illegally. There is one of my books, you can find online already. It's been pirated and you don't have to buy the book, it's there. The other, there's another one of my book that got counterfeited by someone called an independent publisher, and it got sold on Amazon for a little while, but people were saying the font looks funny, the diagrams don't look quite right. And so, you know, Sage had to wrestle with Amazon saying, take this book off, it's not the real deal. So it's happening now. It's happened to John Creswell's books. It happens to several authors. I would say do a search online. You'll probably find what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. As far as more legitimate ways, I guess when we first started moving to ebooks, remember for fiction and such, we said, well, books are going to disappear. And they didn't. I still really like to hold a book in my hand. But if I'm writing, I like to have the e-copy so I can copy the quotes directly in and know that when I'm transcribing over, I won't make an error. And then, of course, it has the whole citation there. And easy. So I kind of work between an e-copy and a hard copy if I can. So that means I have a big shelf of books and this e-copy. But again, that's reflective of the wealth of my university, the wealth of the library subscriptions that I'm able to access. And so I'm very supportive of the people who are thinking in these areas, my librarian that works in these areas, of a higher level of access. And I hope we're headed to something exciting in that area. And I imagine it will be a very hybrid.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with, you know, what Johnny and Ria shared here. I think that open science writ large is really exciting and has been exciting for some time. But I do think it has faced some obstacles, including, you know, which have been written about, you know, including concerns around security, which Johnny's example points to. Also, you know, there's been some writing around how far can we go with open access when fee structures are part of what makes open access possible. And for those of us that work at institutions, I know at my institution, we have a variable pot of money that supports publishing in open access, depends on the year, how much you'll get support for. And sometimes those fees can be really high. And so that can create another layer of access of who can ultimately publish in these places if there's an exorbitant fee. So funding structures, you know, have to be in place as well. I think related to open science for our community as well, an area where there's potential exploration in the future is also thinking about qualitative data repositories. So thinking about the work that Qualitative Data Repository at Syracuse has been doing for quite a long time around depositing and inviting qualitative researchers to share their data for others to engage in secondary analysis. I mean, that's part of open science as well, that within the quantitative methodological community, there's, you know, a long history of that happening. Within our community, less so. So I think as a community, we have opportunity to really wrestle if we want to engage in this open science, what kinds of structures need to be in place? What does it mean to use shared data? What does that mean for our analysis practices and for our conceptualizations of qualitative research? So I think there's good possibility, but lots of questions that we'll have to wrestle with as well.
Well, Sally and Dan, you've been kind of quiet. I've been talking too much. We're kind of nearing the end of our time. So maybe we kind of do one more wrap through in terms of, you know, what people's final thoughts are.
I think you really touched upon lots of themes here. I made some notes about the comments about movement, you know, the representation of movement or how that's done, and the whole emphasis on security and what that means. Security is a big topic, not just in the publishing world, but in our entire world. So there's lots of themes that are bubbling up that extend beyond just COVID, but COVID has been kind of the initiator, has kind of in a way opened up some possibilities for us to think in ways that maybe we were so comfortable not thinking about prior to it.
I just wanted to say that I'm really appreciative of the comments and the ideas that all three of you have expressed. And it really does help me think about helping authors think about the issues that they're facing and could include in their reports, and also about when we're asked for help in designing projects. And so I think that that's really important. The only real question I had, because this was my experience, is similar to what Johnny was saying about the fatigue, but just a fatigue in general, fatigue of being on screen. I just found that, I thought, you know, people were getting stale. There wasn't small chit chat at meetings. There was a lot of the stuff that I think, or the information or the interaction that we need as human beings, that got left out. So, And the warmth, I think that that's what I really suffered from missing. So I would be interested in hearing from you too, because everything, our entertainment was online, our work was online, our conversational exchanges. So
final thoughts from the panelists?
I guess my final thought is, my huge takeaway was the amazing resilience of our students. And so I had said all my students except one were in face-to-face studies, and despite their depression and their situation, some of them, one had six of her children come home to live with her. Another one was trapped away from her infant. They all pulled off these amazing studies. The one that I always think about, he was going to interview older women face-to-face. And so the first interview was him actually showing them how to set up FaceTime, Skype, Zoom. And they were so appreciative because they wanted it to talk to their grandkids. And so you had this extra relational piece that he brought to the study. And then you can believe they spent a lot of time giving him amazing information because they were so appreciative. So this resilience of our students gives me such a wonderful feeling for the future of academia in general.
I was very resistant to technology, but I found out that if I'm too resistant, then I get left behind. So I'm just learning how to embrace it. I'm learning how to exploit it, so that in my vindictive kind of way, technology is not going to rule me. I'm going to rule technology.
Yeah, and Sally, to your point around fatigue, I mean, maybe one way we can conceptualize that as one of the potential consequences of our uses of technology is that some element of fatigue comes be part of your experience. And I also think about with thinking about like Zoom interviews, Zoom focus groups, and how there is something different about the kind of interaction that we have with our participants. What it then invites us to do, I think, as qualitative researchers, is if there's a certain kind of building that I want to build into my process, what might rapport building or in doing rapport, what might it look like in this different context? Because we know interactional contexts all bring unique interactional qualities. So again, I think it just invites us as qualitative researchers, if this is the space I'm collecting data in, or the space I'm even analyzing my data in, what are the consequences and how will I navigate those consequences as I build this digital workflow?
Well, I think maybe the best way of wrapping this session, this is obviously the start of a conversation. We're going to continue across the plenaries. But I don't know if you saw down in the chat, Mimi wrote, I heard COVID reiterated as a lack of joy. We are gradually getting back to the joy. Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the joy. Enjoy the conference. And I really enjoyed our conversation this morning with Maria, Johnny, Jessica, Sally, and Dan. Adam, thank you always for organizing this. And so now we're going to have a short break, and we're going to go to the start of our our different concurrent sessions. And as I say, there's a couple of special things going on today. We have the power lunches. We have the one today is with Envivo, power lunch today, Max QDA on Friday, and Quercos on Saturday. Tomorrow's plenary panel will be representatives from some of the major qualitative data analysis software. So surprise, we're probably gonna talk about more technology tomorrow about that. And then we conclude our three panels on Saturday, talking about how the qualitative report has kind of been navigating through this and how we still find it a joy to work with you all. So thank you so much. Have a great rest of the conference. And I guess I'll be seeing you around on Zoom. Take care.